things in life are more frightening than the C word. But according to one statistic, 40% of us will have a diagnosable cancer at one point or other in our lives. And if that's not bad enough news, the silver lining has always been this: cancer isn't contagious. But research, both old and new, is pointing to a new truth: cancer evolves. And that evolution can include becoming contagious. Hi, I'm Veronica Rickert with you this morning here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and glad to have you along, too. This morning we'll be talking with David Quammen. He wrote the article Contagious Cancer, The Evolution of a Killer, which ran in the April issue of Harper's Magazine. He's also an award-winning science, nature, and travel writer, and author of the book The Song of the Dodo and The Reluctant Mr. Darwin. Well, how concerned do you think people should be about contagious cancer? And just how common is it? Will cancer-busting advances outstrip the evolution of cancer? Well, you can call us up this morning with your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. David Quammen, thanks so much for being with us today.
Good morning, Veronica.
Really fascinating article, especially since you sort of get us into it with the Tasmanian devils, something pretty exotic to most of us here in the States. And their story is a really poignant one and also a scary one. Can you tell us about them?
Yes. Well, the Tasmanian devil is a small marsupial carnivore. It's actually more of a scavenger than a predator, about the size of a coyote. Lives only on the island of Tasmania, which is the southern island of Australia. And it was doing fine until back in 1996, a nature photographer named Christo Bars took some photos that showed strange growths on a couple of these devils. And more people started to notice these growths, and it was eventually discovered that these growths were actual cancerous tumors. People wondered whether there was some environmental cause that was triggering cancer in the devil, which started to show this phenomenon more and more across the island. They thought, well, maybe there's a virus that's being passed from one devil to another that triggers this cancer. But eventually they discovered, no, it's not a virus. It doesn't seem to be an environmental cause. It's an actual transmissible tumor line that's being passed from one devil to another through the facial bites that they give to one another. They battle for mates, they battle over food, they cut each other up in the face, and cells from the tumor itself fall from one devil into the wounds of another and take hold there and grow. Now, that's not supposed to be possible in cancer. It's supposed to be axiomatic that cancer is not transmissible, but the devil is proven now to be one exception, at least, to that axiom.
Well, and one exception, but reading your story, there have been stories of transmissible cancer in humans, albeit not that many, but it has happened, hasn't it?
There are a few cases of tumors being transmitted, for instance, during surgery. A doctor cuts his hand while performing cancer surgery on a patient, and months later he discovers that he's got a tumor growing in his hand. There are a few cases of those that I've identified from the scientific literature. There's also the case of a mother-daughter transplant. A tumor was transplanted into the mother of a 50-year-old cancer patient. This was done for some reason.
It just sounds like a bad idea.
Supposedly to learn something about the immune system reactions that would help the daughter. And the tumor took hold in the mother and eventually killed her. It's rare. It requires very special circumstances in humans, but it does occur. There's a case that occurred in France in the early 20th century of a fellow named Henri Vadon, and he cut his hand during cancer surgery and eventually died of a tumor that had been transmitted to him.
So
very rare, very special circumstances, but it has occurred.
But when these things happen in humans, what do? We just write it off as, well, that was freaky, and then move on with it? I mean, didn't anyone get concerned when these things happened?
No, because the circumstances were so special. Our immune systems recognize cancer, recognize living cells from any other individual, and that is one of the main reasons why cancer is not transmissible. A tumor from another person has a different genetic makeup. Your immune system recognizes it, surrounds it, fights it, kills it, rejects it. It's never, almost never, an issue in humans. So, of course, the situation with the Tasmanian devil raises questions, among others, about the immune systems of the animals. And that turns out to be part of the solution to the mystery.
Well, one of the things, as I understand it, that made this possible with the Tasmanian devil population is that they're really inbred by necessity, I guess, because they were sort of, this is one of the places where they could thrive without predators, and the population there is pretty similar genetically. But I would think that that would not have been one of the cases with the human instances that you were talking about.
No, no, it generally is not. On the other hand, in the human cases, there is a small incidence of cancer transmission in organ transplants. And again, this brings up the question of the immune system. If you get a liver or a kidney or even a heart transplanted from another individual, one of the first things that's done is a certain tissue matching, blood type matching, and then the recipient is given immunosuppressive drugs so that your body does not reject the liver or the other organ. Hmm. And those immunosuppressive drugs are meant to function in helping your body to accept this alien organ. In other words, suppressing your immune system so that that you don't reject it. And there, as I said, there's a small incidence of tumors that come riding in on transplanted drugs, and these statistics are again in the scientific literature, and those tumors are able to take hold because of the immunosuppressed situation and occasionally go forward, grow, and kill the donor recipient. The incidence of that is small enough that if you desperately need a liver or a kidney transplant, you're better off to go ahead with it, but still, these cases have occurred.
So is it generally accepted throughout the scientific community right now that this contagious cancer is an example of the evolution of cancer?
Well, the evolution of cancer is, then we open out into this much larger and more complicated room that I came across in the course of researching this, and that is that scientists have realized that cancerous tumors, in fact, evolve according to Darwinian natural selection, just the way species, well, not just the way, but in a way parallel to the evolution of species. The reason that happens is because cancerous tumors actually contain genetic diversity. There are different cell variants within a cancer tumor that compete against one another, and under the circumstances of competition for blood, competition for the resources at the site of the tumor, the most aggressive of those different variants succeed. And then when you treat a tumor, for instance, with chemotherapy, you are subjecting it to a further form of selection. And again, the most aggressive variants are emerge as successful. And in this way, cancerous tumors actually are capable of evolving toward more and more aggressive forms. There is a researcher named Carlo Maley at an institute in Philadelphia who has published work on this with his colleagues in recent years, and I interviewed for him for this piece. And he talks about this as a phenomenon of cancer evolution by natural selection.
Well, when we think about the word contagious, what immediately comes to mind is a virus. And we're not talking about a viral kind of thing here, right?
That's right.
So it's not like you're going to sneeze and get cancer one day.
No, it's not. It's not contagious in any sense like that. People wanted to believe early on with the the Tasmanian devil that, oh, this must be a case of a virus that's transmissible triggering cancer. There is a chromosome that was done by a woman named Anne Marie Pierce looking at different cells from different tumors from different devils. And what she found was that these different tumors all had chromosome mutations that were identical from one to another. And that could not happen if the tumors were being triggered individually by a virus that was passed from one devil to another. That could only be true if the cells of the tumor themselves were being passed. And that way, this very unique chromosome signature would be turning up in one tumor after another. And that is, in fact, the case.
Well, give us a sense what all of this means for cancer research and for people who get cancer.
Well, it probably doesn't have any enormously alarming implications for human health, and I want to emphasize that. This is a phenomenon happening in the Tasmanian devil, happening in a few other animals. We haven't talked about the case in dogs, but there is also a transmissible tumor known in dogs called canine venereal transmissible tumor that's been around for more than 100 years. These are very special circumstances, and they remind us that cancer is an evolutionary process, but they remind us also that the immune system, when it's functioning properly, when there is sufficient genetic diversity within the population, whether it's humans or Tasmanian devils or any other species, that this is a phenomenon that's highly, highly, highly unlikely to happen, but it can happen. So I don't want people to run away from this and think, we should think of cancer as a contagious disease. Generally, it is not. And when people take care of cancer patients, when they have contact with their relatives, and all of us have or will have relatives who suffer cancer, is there a danger of contagiousness? No, emphatically not. The message from this is a couple of degrees more complicated scientifically than that.
Well, do you see this as changing sort of the landscape of cancer research in the next decade?
Well, yes. People are learning some things about cancer research. For instance, the researcher that I mentioned, Carlo Maley, with his work on a phenomenon called Barrett's esophagus, which is a precancerous condition in humans. That's what he has studied, and he has found that Barrett's esophagus is a precancerous condition that is monitored year by year, and the clinical evidence that Carlo Maley and his colleagues have looked at shows that the more genetic diversity there is in a Barrett's esophagus neoplasm or a precancerous growth, the more genetic diversity that's there, the more likely that is to turn into a malignant tumor. And that's because, again, of natural selection. The most aggressive forms are the ones that succeed. So this has certain implications for how to watch for the possibility of cancer developing in a given person, a given precancerous growth turning into cancer. It does have complicated but very fascinating implications for cancer treatment, cancer monitoring in humans.
Is anybody working on it now that the case of the Tasmanian devils has hit the public eye? Are cancer researchers shifting focus?
I would say that this is the Tasmanian devil situation is not likely to be causing a great shift in focus among researchers on human cancers. But Carlo Maley and his colleagues and a few other people continue to study cancer from the evolutionary perspective. Cancer as an evolutionary phenomenon. And it's enormously important to understand it that way.
Well, why did we ever think that it was outside the realm of evolution?
Well, when you go through medical school, you generally do not study evolutionary biology. That might sound odd, but it is the case. Evolutionary biologists and oncologists, medical researchers, cancer specialists have essentially lived in two very different scientific worlds for most of the 20th century into this century. And it was only back in about 1976 when a fellow named Peter Noel published a scientific paper called Cancer as an Evolutionary Phenomenon that theorists began to think of it that way. And it was only sort of a small school or a small vein of theorists, mostly on the evolutionary biology side, thinking of cancer as an evolutionary phenomenon. Had very little impact, very little crossover into clinical cancer treatment or research. And then in very recent years, people like Carlo Maley, who I mentioned, began to find that this was not just a fascinating theoretical idea, but that there was clinical evidence in the form of Barrett's esophagus patients that would support this idea, seeing cancer as subject to Darwinian evolution by natural selection.
I guess it just seems shocking to me that among a group of scientists that they would consider something found in the natural world as also being outside the laws of evolution.
Well, you have to talk to the people who organize medical training, I guess. It seems odd to us that doctors and medical researchers would not be imbued with evolutionary biology, but the fact is that that medical training generally is a field that does not pay much attention to evolutionary biology.
Hmm. Well, I guess, is the possibility still open? You said, you know, there's really not much to worry about in terms of, you know, being around people who have cancers now, that the few cases of transmissible cancer in humans were really special circumstances, you say. But since we're saying here, cancer does evolve, do we have to worry that, you know, we could be seeing more of that sort of evolution being passed maybe in different ways in people down the road?
Well, again, let me take you back to the case of the dog tumor. Just to understand better how this can happen in another species. Now, we talked about the Tasmanian devil having not much genetic diversity. We haven't actually said why. The Tasmanian devil has been subjected to persecution at a number of times over the last couple of hundred years because it is very much hated by sheep ranchers in Tasmania. So there have been bounties on it. It has been nearly exterminated in large parts of the island. Its population has been driven down very low during a couple of different periods, and then the population has been allowed to bounce back when people change their attitudes about Tasmanian devils. They've started to realize, well, this is a wonderful, unique species to our island. Let's protect it. The population has been allowed to grow back. But genetic diversity always bounces back much, much more slowly than sheer population numbers. So after nearly having been exterminated on the island of Tasmania, the devil has bounced back, but its genetic diversity has not. So its gene pool is very, very small. That's one of the conditions that has allowed the tumor in the devil to be transmissible. But then there's this case of the canine transmissible venereal tumor in dogs. It's been known since 1876. Now, dogs do not have a small gene pool. There's a lot of genetic diversity in dogs around the world, and yet this tumor can be passed in the act of mating from one dog to another. That's why they call it a venereal tumor. It's passed like a venereal disease, but again, it's not a virus. It's not some sort of a microbial agent. It's actually a tumor, a lineage of cells passed from one dog to another, despite the fact that there's great genetic diversity. How has that happened? It seems that this particular tumor has evolved a way of circumventing immune systems in dogs so that, despite the genetic diversity, their immune systems do not recognize it.
And how does this apply to people?
It could happen in people. It's very, very unlikely. It's a very rare situation in dogs, and again, what I keep saying is that we should not be alarmed. We should not assume that this is something that's likely to happen in a cancerous lineage in people. It could happen. Again, though, I don't want to go too much into the tangles of the science of the dog tumor, but the fact that it is a venereal tumor means that the cells are more easily passed from one individual to another mm-hmm. than, for instance, lung cancer could be passed, or a colon cancer could be passed, because living cells are very delicate in the external environment in a way that bacteria and virus are not, so that it's very rare for them to be passed from one person to another. In the act of mating, there's very close contact, so that cells can be passed. So I don't mean this to be an alarming statement, but if there were to develop a contagious form of cancer in humans, chances are that it would be a venereal form, like this venereal tumor in dogs.
We're going to take a break right now, and then we'll come back and take some of your calls as we talk with David Qualman, who is an award-winning travel, science, and nature writer, and he's the author of Song of the Dodo and The Reluctant Mr. Darwin. Also, the article Contagious Cancer, The Evolution of a Killer, which ran in the April issue of Harper's Magazine. Well, we'd love to hear from you this morning with your questions and comments. Do you think we should be concerned about contagious cancer? And do you think maybe cancer-busting advances would outstrip that evolution? Well, whatever your question, you can call us up this morning at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hope you'll stay around next hour as we find out if you're suffering from adultitis. Well, you may be if you fear change, rarely laugh, and spend most of the day in a job you don't love. After 10, adultitis, the symptoms and the cure. This hour, we're talking with David Qualman, who wrote the article Contagious Cancer, The Evolution of a Killer, which ran in the April issue of Harper's Magazine. He's also the author of the book The Reluctant Mr. Darwin. We have an open phone line for you this morning if you'd like to ask David Qualman your questions or your thoughts about contagious cancer. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. And let's go ahead and take a phone call now. We've got Warren on the line from Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Warren.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
What's your question?
Well, we've been talking about all this cancer and how it's kind of, well, it's evolutionary now, we know that. But what we don't know how to do is prevent the cancer. And it seems that with our technologies, we've been tapping out on other viruses, and these viruses just come back to be stronger, and so we're kind of making super viruses. If we treat our cancer with chemotherapy and whatnot, won't we just be making stronger cancers? And I guess just how you can prevent that, or how we are working to treat that.
Great question. David Qualman?
It is a good question. Yes, that is a concern. One of the things that the researchers in the Carlo Maley group that I've mentioned have been saying is that recognizing the evolutionary phenomenon that takes place in cancers has important implications for instance, how we conduct chemotherapy and how we should conduct chemotherapy. It reminds us that, yes, treating a cancerous tumor with a single anti-cancer drug can cause a selection process that gives you simply a more aggressive tumor, just the way, for instance, treating a bacterial disease with antibiotics creates antibiotic-resistant bacteria. The implications of that some of them are far over my head, but they include the idea that you probably need to treat a cancerous tumor with a cocktail of drugs, a number of different drugs that would attack different lineages within the genetic diversity of the cancerous tumor, and and deal with this problem of potential resistance arising that way. So, yes, that's absolutely one of the implications of this research and this realization.
Thank you, Warren. And let's go on now to Bill calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Bill.
Good morning.
Morning.
In every case that you cited, the tumor has been transmitted through blood, including the humans issues. Why should we not be concerned about blood transfusions?
Good question. I suspect that blood transfusions have the same sort of potential as organ transplants in humans, that it is possible that there could be a form of blood cancer that was carried in a blood transfusion. I should add that I don't know anything about the way blood for blood transfusions is screened. There may be some screening that takes account of that, but just as in a liver transplant, a kidney transplant, a heart transplant, there is a small possibility that cancerous cells could be carried and could take hold in the recipient. I suspect that there is that possibility in a blood transfusion, too. But again, the odds of suffering from the cancer occurring, if you need a blood transfusion, are very, very low, and your risk from that is much lower than your risk without the transfusion. So it's something that that medical people need to be aware of. I suspect that they are very much aware of it. It's probably not a major concern for the rest of us.
Well, that reminds me of one of the comforting things in your article is you talk about just how many mutations need to happen before a cell becomes malignant, and it is kind of a long process.
It is. Scientists believe now that probably on average there's a need for at least 5 or 6 mutations within a single cell lineage to turn that cell into a malignant endlessly reproducing cancerous lineage. And those 5 or 6 mutations, maybe that doesn't sound like much, but they all have to occur in the right place in the same lineage of cells. And when you do the arithmetic, it becomes very, very, very unlikely that any cell is going to mutate into a cell that has lost all of the inbuilt mechanisms to prevent it from reproducing endlessly. But in the course of our lives, we have a lot of cell divisions occurring in our bodies. I can't remember the exact numbers right now, but it's in the billions or trillions of cell reproductions in the course of a human life. So that those numbers are very, very large, and even though the odds of any cell replication yielding a cancerous lineage is very remote, again, you do the arithmetic, and the very, very remote event becomes something that's reasonably likely to happen in a full human lifetime. That's why something like 40% of us in the United States sometime during our lives will be diagnosed with cancer.
Is that number holding steady?
I don't know, Veronica. That's the current number. I suspect that it has been over the course of, the last 100 years, it's probably gone up because people are living longer. Cancer seems to be more prevalent now, but it's because we're surviving long enough to get cancer and not dying earlier of other diseases.
Well, I also know that cancer survival rates have gone up, haven't they?
They certainly have, yeah.
Okay, back to the phones. Here is Deborah calling from Waukegan, Illinois. Hi, Deborah. Thanks for calling.
Yes, I had just sort of anecdotally thought, partly because of people in my own family, I'm wondering if the statistics for development of cancer are higher among cancer researchers. And, of course, you've touched on some of the reasons that might occur, things, you know, the surgeon that you mentioned and so forth. But I just wondered if that has been studied.
I don't know if it has been, Deborah. Very interesting question. I would be very, very surprised if there is much incidence of cancer among cancer researchers related to the actual laboratory work that they're doing, though. Things like dealing with cancerous cell lineages, performing surgery, there are only very, very special and improbable circumstances that lead to a transfer of a tumor into a human. My guess is that it's not showing up in the statistics.
Well, thank you for that call, Deborah. And we have an email from John in Milwaukee I want to share. It says, if there is a vaccine that prevents cancer in humans, in this case a vaccine for preventing cervical cancer, doesn't that already prove that cancer is being transmitted from humans to humans?
My guess is that that vaccine operates on a virus that triggers cervical cancer. I don't know the specifics of that case, but again, people are always... When the idea of transmissible cancer is proposed, people are very, very likely to confuse that with the different phenomenon of the transfer of a virus from one human to another, the virus triggering mutations, the mutations leading eventually to a malignancy, to a cancerous cell line. Those are completely different phenomena. Yes, we can vaccinate against viruses. Yes, viruses occasionally, in a number of different cases, trigger cancer. That's very, very different from transmissible cancer lineages.
Okay, we'll take a call now from Ruth in Waukesha. Hello, Ruth. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
I don't have a lot of background on this, but I have read some information from a gentleman named Doug Kaufman, who has written a book on the cancer fungus link, and he feels that cancer may be caused, in some cases, by fungal, and cited some examples of leukemia patients who were treated after chemotherapy and after developing candida, were treated with antifungals, and the leukemia actually disappeared. So I would like to have some thoughts on that.
Well, part of that makes sense to me, and part of it is very mysterious. The idea that a fungus, like a virus, might trigger a cancer is comprehensible. Anything that can cause mutations in cells as cells replicate potentially can cause cancer. Because, again, as we've said, five or six mutations in a cell lineage, these mutations occurring during cell replication, the process of mitosis, in which cells reproduce themselves, can lead to those accumulation of mutations, and eventually you get a runaway cell replication, which is cancer. But if a fungus is triggering cancer in humans, I don't understand how treating the fungus then could result in a reduction of the cancer once it's taken hold. Maybe you could... Can you explain that a little bit?
No, because I haven't read the research on it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was interesting to note that just the antifungal drugs, whatever they were, when administered to the leukemia patients, caused that to go into remission. And I'm wondering why there wasn't more research done around that whole phenomena.
Yeah, I can't answer that. That's curious.
Did you say it was old research or new research?
It's probably old,
because
I think this has been around for a while, but the gentleman's name is Doug Kaufman.
Okay.
Well, one of the things we should remember is that the world of cancer research is huge and diverse. There's a lot of money that's been going into it for decades and decades. There are a lot of ideas out there. There are a lot of different researchers working on things. Most of it, the results are published in scientific journals, never make it into the newspapers. I'm sure there are possible lines of research that aren't being followed, aren't being funded, but it's a huge jumble out there of the ideas, the lines of attack that are being pursued, and most of it never makes it to the media that we see.
Going to take another quick break now and then come back and take more of your phone calls this morning as we talk with David Quammen, who wrote the article Contagious Cancer, The Evolution of a Killer. It ran in the April issue of Harper's Magazine. He's also the author of the book The Reluctant Mr. Darwin. Well, how concerned are you about contagious cancer? And you have questions for David Quammen about the Tasmanian devil cancer that sprung up and what's being done there. The number to call this morning, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. At 12:30 today, stay tuned for Chapter a Day as Jim Fleming reads from The Appeal by John Grisham. And then at 1 o'clock, it's Talk of the Nation Science Friday. The subject today, offshore drilling and alternative energy. Veronica Rickert back with you today here on the Ideas Network as we talk with David Quammen about his article, Contagious Cancer, The Evolution of a Killer. If you'd like to ask David Quammen a question, you can call us this morning at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And we'll go back to the phones now. Here is a call from Sheppy joining us from Ashland. Hi, Sheppy.
Hi, Veronica. Fascinating show. I have a question for David and for you, I guess, about the use of the term evolution. I think it's being used in two different senses. On the one hand, David, when you talk about somebody who's who has cancer being treated with chemotherapy or other treatments, and the fact that different cancer cells are selected for when they're treated, that is one form of, you know, one use of the word
Sheppy,
evolution.
Sheppy, can I jump in and ask you to speak up? You're very, very soft.
Sure.
Oh,
is this any better?
That's a lot better, yeah.
Okay. So when evolution happens within an individual patient, when that person passes away, those changes are going to pass on with them. On the other hand, evolution can be used to mean that over a period of generations, that the disease changes. And that, those are really two separate uses of the same word, the word evolution.
Okay, did you catch that, David Quammen?
I did, yes. That's true, Sheppy. Unless the cell lineage has passed from one individual to another, whether it's a Tasmanian devil or, in those rare cases, a human, in which case the evolutionary phenomenon continues. For instance, in this case that I've talked about in dogs, canine transmissible venereal tumor, they call it CTVT, it seems that this has been passing among dogs at least for the last 125, 150 years. It might be much older than that. And changes, evolutionary changes, seem to have accumulated in it to the degree that it is it's able to evade the immune systems of dogs, despite the fact that dogs have high genetic diversity. It's able to evade their immune systems by a process that the scientists called down-regulating its antigens, which essentially means blurring the signals on the exterior of cells that immune systems use to identify and take hold of alien cell lines. So that in this sense, the evolutionary process has been continuing in this lineage within individuals and from one individual dog to another, creating what seems to be sort of a super cancer that is transmissible during the mating process.
Well, and yet, as you report in your articles, it seems like this is not a fatal cancer for dogs. Many of them, it sounds like almost all of them, either recover with treatment or their bodies just throw it off themselves.
That's right. It's not nearly as aggressive as the Tasmanian devil's tumor. It can be treated, and in some cases, their immune systems eventually identify it and reject it, although in some cases, it develops into a malignancy and can be fatal in dogs, too. So it's threatening, but it's not nearly as aggressive as the devil tumor disease.
Well, thank you for that call, Sheffy. And let's take one now from Jeff calling from Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I was just wondering, I missed the first part of the program, but I'm interested in the infectious. Usually when you think of something being infectious or transmissible, you think of it as being infectious. And what comes to mind, or at least what we've been doing some research on for a number of years, these protein folding diseases. So
say that again, Jeff, the which kind of diseases?
Protein folding diseases, you know, mm-hmm. like some of the weird, there's a
right,
big group
right.
of
prions or prions.
On prions, yeah. yeah. And, it, you know, it's always thought that the protein itself is directly, you know, transmissible, I guess, and infectious.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, I've, it's not published yet, but I've heard some people or saw some initial work that implied that this may apply to other other diseases who have these protein folding diseases, like Alzheimer's and a variety of other ones.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, and we may develop these transmissible proteins, but we just haven't found them yet. In the selection for cancer, and the selection of more aggressive tumor cells,
mm-hmm.
I mean, is there any evidence at all that the proteins from those cells could actually be transmissible?
Well, it seems to me two very different phenomena. I mean, the protein folding, the prions, and this may be the sort of thing that you're researching. Like, for instance, they cause chronic wasting disease in elk and deer. Is that right?
Yeah, and then they do. There's a lot of mouse and rodent models that you can cause massive vertigo generation and
mm-hmm.
sponge formation in the brain. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But for instance, in the Tasmanian devil, the disease progresses much, much more quickly than protein folding diseases generally do. Aren't they generally, I mean, we used to call those things slow viruses, right?
Yeah, it depends on the model. I know groups that inject mice with prion, you know, mutated prion protein, and they'll, within 4 to 8 weeks, they'll show massive phenotypic symptoms of, you know, brain effects. So.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like it's some kind of a virus. You know, it's almost as potent as a virus as far as manifesting its phenotype.
In terms of how quickly it...
Yeah,
but,
it's really amazing stuff.
But the effects that you see after that period of time, isn't it some sort of a... don't they call it spongiform encephalitis?
Yeah, the brain
starts
getting
breakdown of
cold.
The tissues.
Yeah.
It turns spongy. It has gaps in it.
Yeah.
And that's very different from what you see in a cancer, which is the uncontrolled replication of cells, right?
Yeah, and this is kind of a way out there theory, but if the you know, selection for example, if you give chemotherapy to a patient and you select for this more aggressive tumor, which they call a multi-drug resistant phenotype, mm-hmm. and the cells grow. Now, if most of those patients probably die from the aggressive tumor and nobody's probably ever looked at, you know, those aggressive tumors to see if proteins that are in those cells may actually be transmissible or taken up by other cells and transforming them into tumors.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an interesting thought. I don't know if anybody's done it or not.
Nobody has, in the case of the Tasmanian devil that I'm aware of. As a matter of fact, I'm sure they haven't done that particular research. I suppose it's possible, but it seems to me a potential add-on problem to the problem of the tumor itself rather than an explanation for the cancerous infectious transmission.
So for the rest of us, what is protein folding exactly?
is it Jeff?
Yeah. What happens is a protein such as a protein in Alzheimer's disease or in prion disease or ALS or Parkinson's disease, you'll have proteins that get mutations in them, then that what they do is they actually, it changes their structure a little bit, and what happens is then the protein begins to aggregate and form large clumps together. And so when you see an Alzheimer's disease, you'll see plaque.
Mm-hmm.
In Parkinson's disease, you'll see inclusion bodies in the cells. In Huntington's disease, you'll see these inclusion bodies in cells. So it's thought that these protein aggregates then plug up the cell's ability to get rid of these bad proteins, and then the accumulation of these bad proteins and these aggregates, you know, lead to these diseases.
Veronica, another way of thinking of it is imagine a road map, a folded up road map, and you unfold it, and there's one correct way to refold that road map, and we all have struggled with this and thinking, wait a minute, that's not the right way to fold it. Which is the way that this road map wants to get folded back together? And when one of these diseases takes place, they call it a prion or a protein folding problem. It means that the protein, which is this complicated structure that should have hinges in certain places and should function in a spread out form, suddenly wants to fold itself in the wrong ways, and it keeps sort of slapping itself closed like a road map, slapping itself closed along the wrong fold so that you can't make any use of it. And it's contagious in that it passes from one protein to another and transmits this this mistaken folding pattern from one to another, and eventually causes the proteins to be unfunctional and create big spongy gaps, for instance, in the brain of a victim.
All right. Well, thank you for your thoughts, Jeff. Interesting stuff. And let's take another call now from Bill in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Yes, I'm a physician and have worked in the American Cancer Society for a long time. And we knew back in the 40s and 50s that an uncircumcised male was the carrier of the virus that would cause venereal warts. Today, if almost 60 years later, we know that all cervical cancers come from a virus transmitted by the male to the female to create this wart, which will mutate, if you want to call it that, into a cervical cancer. But we know that all cervical cancers come from such a contact, much like the Tasmanian dog.
But again, Bill, I would make the distinction between an actual cancerous cell line transmitted through sexual contact or through biting and a virus transmitted in either of those ways that triggers cancer. I mean, obviously, they're both of concern, but the biological phenomenon is different, right?
But you know that you can take tissues into eggs and put cancer cells, and they'll grow. And yes, we will agree with you 100% that we do transmit between each other in the ways that you mentioned. But that's not that's not a common method, as you say. This is a very common method.
Right. Yep. I agree.
Okay. Well, thank you, Bill, for that call. And time for probably just one more from Jerry Lynn in Toma. Hi, Jerry Lynn. You're up. Hello. Are you there?
Jerry Lynn?
Yeah. Jerry Lynn, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, go ahead. What's your thought?
Yes. Yes, I am. I know we were created with a body that's very complex. And the air, water, stress, and nutrition take a part in the whole picture of cancer. And I guess basically I was thinking of some things that I have read, studied, and I saw a clip on a movie of pomegranate that seems to kill a fungus. And I'm wondering what David, the doctor, I'm sorry, I'm not recalling his last name.
David Quammen, sure.
But I'm wondering if he feels that, like, some of the tropical fruits and all of that have a bearing on this cancer.
And you're talking
also,
about...
my other question was that oxygen-rich blood, a cancer can't survive in it. And acid seems to be another situation, and I'm wondering about the antioxidants such as chlorella. And another thing was that Well, that's enough for right now.
Okay, thank you, Jerry Lynn. So I guess she's asking, essentially, it sounds like a lot of cancer prevention things, and we've got about a minute left to go, David Quammen.
Okay, Veronica. Well, thank you, Jerry Lynn. It's certainly possible that antioxidants, that tropical fruits, that pomegranate might have some effect, for instance, on fungus that triggers a cancer. She mentioned fungus. I don't know what else to say about the impacts of diet on cancer prevention. Again, I think what we're talking about there are the viral, bacterial, or fungal agents that may trigger mutations that cause cancer. Certainly a concern, but again, very different from this peculiar situation that we're discussing in the Tasmanian devil.
So bottom line here, we shouldn't be too worried yet.
No, the reason I wrote the article was to alert people to the situation that's happening in Tasmania. A wonderful creature is suffering a horrible epidemic of a very improbable sort, contagious cancer, and it has its echoes in dogs and in humans in certain very restricted cases. And it reminds us that we're all connected, and that, yes, cancer is an evolutionary phenomenon.
Well, I'm sorry, we're going to have to leave it there, but it's been a fascinating hour, and I really thank you for your time.
Monica, good to be with you.
Thank you so much. David Quammen, author of Contagious Cancer, which ran in Harper's. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.